This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all know that weather affects our daily lives. We feel better when the sun is shining and the air is warm. But too much heat for long periods of time without moisture can cause serious drought. Gardeners love the rain, but rain can spoil a good picnic. Skiers look forward to cold and snow, but snow can wreak havoc on highways and city streets and air travel. I suppose that's why we pay so much attention to the weather people on TV. We want to know how to prepare for what the weather has in store. For how the weather will alter or impact our day. But we weren't always able to rely on forecasts. Indeed, forecasts are a relatively modern invention. So throughout history, weather has been able to play a role in how human events unfolded. In every human era, from the present day reaching back to D-Day in Europe to the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, the Salem witch trials, Hitler's invasion of Russia, Napoleon's exit from Russia, all of those events were altered by the weather. And now there are those looking at ways to deliberately manipulate the weather to give humans a tactical advantage in certain situations. Laura Lee has written extensively about this in her book, Blame It on the Rain, How Weather Has Changed the Course of History. And she joins us by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And in our Spirit Square studios, Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist with WCNC-TV, who sees the impact of weather on us mere mortals on a daily basis and was himself impacted by it while working for WWL-TV in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Welcome back. Laura, you've written a lot of books on a lot of different topics, which run a pretty wide gamut of subject matter. What made you interested in researching and writing about the weather and its impact on history?
Well, I actually, my father had written a book on the weather. My father's name was Albert Lee, and he wrote a book about weather folklore and the science behind it and how you could watch the birds and determine what the weather would be like the next day. And he had always encouraged me to try to do an update of that. And a publisher of mine had contacted me, and they wanted someone to do a book on the weather, and I did a proposal. And one chapter of it was about how weather impacted history. And in the end, they weren't interested in the book, but I thought the one chapter was more interesting than the whole subject. And so I expanded on that. And it was actually a battle in the War of the Roses and that had gotten me interested. I like to read a lot of books on history and all kinds of topics, and in this particular battle, I have trouble keeping track of all of those old English monarchs. And, you know, they have all their family alliances. But in the War of the Roses, in the Battle of Barnet, you had these two sides that were both descendants of Edward III who were vying it out. And over many years, they'd been fighting and changing alliances. And on the day of the battle, there was a huge fog. They could barely see. And one side had a banner that was stars with streams, and the other had suns with rays. So they looked a lot alike. And they couldn't figure out which side was aligned with them, which side was their enemy, and they ended up attacking their own allies and thinking that they'd changed alliances, and the whole thing turned into chaos. And that got me interested in how weather can turn the course of history.
That was a fog. I'm going to talk about fog later in the program because a lot of things that fog seems to affect. You actually, Brad, wrote a term paper on this in college.
Yeah.
You told me.
It was interesting because obviously I wanted to be a meteorologist since I was a little kid. So when I went to college, obviously I'd take elective courses, and one of my electives was Poli Sci 210. And we were tasked to do a term paper on some political aspect of politics. And so as a meteorology major, I figured, why not do a term paper on how presidential election turnout was affected by the weather? And so I did a 26-page paper on how the weather affected turnout during presidential elections. And depending on region of the country, political affiliations, you know, I come to find that certain weather impacts certain voting blocks in certain parts of the country. And it's pretty fascinating that maybe over the history of our country, stormy weather in the southeast or a snowy November in the Northeast may have impacted turnout from certain demographics and certain voting blocks that could have had impacts on presidential elections.
Do you remember who seems to be more affected by this? Is it Democrats or Republicans, older people, younger people? Is it snow or rain? I mean, what seems to have the most impact?
It seems to be more in the South, where inclement weather will deter Democratic turnout, because when you find lower income voters who don't have transportation to the polls, who actually have to walk or use public transportation, you're less likely to go out if there's rainy weather. So if there's rainy weather in certain parts of the country where you're counting on a huge Democratic turnout, it may, even if it's a small percentage, it could have an impact long range. Now, in the Northeast and the Midwest, where you don't typically get a lot of winter weather, but occasionally there's been winter weather in November, it tends to not deter turnout quite as much because those people are actually pretty used to getting out in inclement
and they
weather.
Have better public transportation.
Exactly. And so it really depends on the part of the country that you're looking at.
Republican strategists should continue listening, because later on in the program we'll talk about manipulating the weather, and you can you can find out how to seed the clouds for a lower Democratic turnout. Laura, you say that overcast skies impact our outlook and expectations. The rains have the power to alter our moods and politics, hospital admissions, and even to change history. How do overcast skies alter our outlook and expectations?
Well, I think everyone has subjectively experienced this, that there are days when you get up, and where I am right now, I'm in the Detroit area, we have snow and it's gray outside, and you're just not quite as motivated to get up and go and you know, start your day and go attack things. Whereas here in the Detroit area, again, to cite another example, in 1967, when there were a lot of tensions and it was very hot, that was kind of a spark in a powder keg. So, and it set off the Detroit riots, or was an element that set off the riots in Detroit. So, you know, we're swayed by what's going on around us and by how we feel in the weather, and that affects how we relate to people, what things we're going to do that day, and whether we're out and about to get into conflicts or to take on the world, or whether we're sitting and moping and looking at a gray sky.
when you say rains have the power to alter hospital admissions, in what way do they do that?
Well, of course, there are the obvious accidents and so on.
Okay.
I think also the level of attention that people have because of their moods on those really nice sunny days. You have a good mood and you're more focused, and so there is a correlation, I guess.
Let's talk about that. Rain usually comes with low pressure, and high pressure usually brings sunshine and fair weather. So are we affected or impacted, do you think, Brad, by the barometric pressure?
Oh.
Or is it the outcome of the barometric pressure?
No, I think it's absolutely the barometric pressure. I think if you have an injury or arthritis, I get this all the time. Like I know when a storm is coming, Brad, because my hip, my knee, my joints start to hurt. There's actually some science behind that. As the pressure gets reduced in the atmosphere, the little air pockets that form in your joints, which, you know, most people have, will expand because the air pressure isn't pushing on them to shrink them. And when they expand, it puts pressure on your joints, which in turn causes pain. So low pressure will often cause joints to actually ache if you have inflammation. So that may be another reason why a lot of people may end up going to the hospital, because maybe they have a pain that they've never experienced before. And really low pressure will bring that out. High pressure, though, in the wintertime, especially when we get these big Arctic highs, which we're talking like, you know, huge high pressure, will actually push down on us. And if you're prone to, let's say, headaches, it will actually constrict blood vessels in your brain, restricting blood flow. And people that are prone to migraines, a big Arctic high moving in during the wintertime may actually spur a migraine attack. So there are ways that atmospheric pressure has huge impacts. And then there's the old wives' tale, which is actually somewhat true, that if you're at 8 or 9 months in pregnancy and a big storm is approaching, typically hurricanes or blizzards, the low pressure could be enough to prompt labor. So a lot of times you've seen people that are right close to that 9-month time frame, with people that are pregnant, that a big low pressure system would actually be just enough influence to cause a woman to go into labor.
WCNC's Brad Panovich proving once again that the weather person is the smartest person on local news. You know everything, you people. Meteorologists know everything.
We try.
Laura, you write about weather in Russia wreaking havoc on two different armies. In 1812, Napoleon invaded Russia with more than 600,000 troops, and they had great success. And they were coming home with great plunder. Then winter set in, and temperatures fell to minus 40 degrees centigrade, and the soldiers fell to frostbite and starvation. Hitler invades Russia many years later with similar success until the weather gets in the way. The Nazis brought dress uniforms to parade through Red Square, but they didn't bring winter uniforms to fight in. That defeat was a turning point in the war. How could Hitler not have learned from Napoleon?
I don't know. Hitler even had advisors telling him, you know, that the weather was going to be more of a factor than he thought. I think that he was very confident that this would be a very fast invasion, that the Russians were no match for him, that they would get in and out. And that is a recurring motif. I have chapters called Gee, It's Cold in Russia, part one, part two, part three, because even before Napoleon and Hitler, there was King Charles of Sweden who tried the same thing. And you would think the Swedes would understand cold weather. And I think the combination of underestimating the determination of those hardy Russian people and how quickly the weather changes in Russia and, you know, how dramatic the Russian winter is and how early it comes tends to do them in.
Were winters more severe then during Napoleon's time and perhaps even during World War II than they are today, given what we think is climate change? Or do we even know? Did that even play a factor? Because it seems to me if you're used to severe winters, then you know they're coming.
Yeah, I think that hubris probably played more of a role than particularly severe weather. Russia's weather, you know, it can fluctuate a lot. It can be very cold at one point and then get warm, and that was part of the problem as well. Not just the cold, but that it would freeze and then it would melt, and you'd get stuck in mud and can't move, and I think that both Napoleon and Hitler just assumed that they would get out much more quickly than they did.
And you write in I think It Gets Cold in Russia, Gee, It's Cold in Russia, Part 3, that because of what happened with Napoleon, he asked an astronomer to modernize weather prediction, and that resulted in the first network of weather stations through France. Is that correct?
Yeah, and so that goes back to why Hitler didn't learn from that history. A lot of the Greeks started studying weather to be able to predict the winds and so on for war purposes as well. So I think that the military advantages of understanding the weather have been known for a long time.
Hmm. Could they really understand the weather? I don't know if you know the answer to this, Brad. I only have 20 seconds, but could they really understand the weather in ancient Greece?
They probably only knew the short-term weather. They were very familiar with seasons. They knew the seasons very well, but from short-term forecasting, we're probably talking hours to a day as opposed to the 5 to 7 days that we know today.
We have to take a break. We'll come back on more and take a closer look at the impact of weather on history and human events in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Festival 2013, presenting Protect Your Money with Dr. Neil Bernard tonight at 9:30. Information at unctv.org. I have three words for you: salt, sugar, and fat. Those three ingredients are way hard to avoid in the American diet. They've been added to packaged foods, and unless you cook for yourself, you can't really tell how much salt, sugar, and fat you're getting in every meal that you eat. In fact, they've been added to make our food taste better and to alter our taste so that we crave those three ingredients. We've become addicted to them. How did this happen? The short answer is deliberately. And we'll talk to Michael Moss, an investigative journalist who's looked into this with the New York Times and a book of his own, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a deadly germ growing more drug-resistant is on the rise in U.S. hospitals. How public health officials plan to fight the spread of a new superbug.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for that conversation this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here sitting in the studio with Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist with WCNC-TV. And Laura Lee joins us by phone. She's the author of Blame It on the Rain, How Weather Has Changed the Course of History. You brought up the ancient Greeks a minute ago, Laura. Talk a bit about how sea breezes essentially saved Western culture. I think you write that this happened in 486 B.C., when the Persian Empire tried to invade Greece, but they were foiled by the wind.
Yeah, well, in the Greek Greco-Persian Wars, the Persian Empire was really at the peak of its strength, and they were poised to take over Greece. They had a huge navy. They had they were well more equipped in terms of the number of ships, and what the Greeks did was they tried to use their advantage of understanding the wind and the waterways around them to steer the Persians into a place where they would be against the wind and trapped essentially. And it was fairly easy for them because Xerxes, who was the attacker, his technique was to intimidate them. He thought that intimidation would rule the day. So he sent people out in advance to say, yes, we need food for this many men when they come and take over. So they knew exactly that they were coming. So they lured them into a channel where the breeze would be working against them. And they sailed straight up and basically found themselves penned in because they had too many ships. And the Greeks were able to win the day and turn the course of that attack.
A lot of the book that you write about are things that the disastrous things that happen because of the weather and not understanding the weather or not paying attention to the weather. But not everything is bad. Sometimes reputations are made on the weather. And you write in your book about how in 1752, a Frenchman tried to duplicate Benjamin Franklin's alleged attempt to draw lightning out of a cloud with a key and a kite. The Frenchman died. But you say another American, of course, made an attempt in 2003 with some success, and that man was Tom Tucker, who is now a retired instructor at Isothermal Community College. He's the author of several books, including Bolt of Fate, Benjamin Franklin, and His Electric Kite Hoax. And he joins us for a few minutes here by phone. Tom, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What exactly did you do? Did you stand out there in a field with a kite on a string with a key and a lightning storm? What's wrong with you?
Let me set that record straight. I did try to replicate the 18th century materials he describes when he talks about doing this experiment, but I decided I wasn't going to do it in a thunderstorm. What I did is I tried to figure out what he meant by a silk handkerchief, what that would have been in terms of the textile technologies going on then. He used red cedar, which was common in the colonies, so I had a local carpenter who worked in unusual woods cut me strips of red cedar that would work. I used a knitting needle for my first experiment for a point on top. I went through all the 18th century stuff as best I could replicate it, and I put the equivalent of a latchkey. I didn't have an 18th century latchkey, so I took an eye bolt that weighed about a quarter of a pound and tried that. And And then also I attached a tail, which probably would have been cotton, perhaps, in Franklin's time, or wool, perhaps even wool. And so, you know, if all this stuff was wet and you were trying to get it up in the air, it just wouldn't have happened. It would have sank like an anchor, at least in my cases, the various times I tried. Huh. It did.
So let's go back to Benjamin Franklin. There's some question, and your book points out that it may have been a hoax. There's some question about whether he actually did this. The question I have is, why would he do it? Why was he interested in flying a kite in a thunderstorm? What was he trying to prove?
Well, actually, he was proposing a perfectly valid experiment. It wasn't an idea that he was first with. Several people in the Royal Society articles mentioned years before, you know, maybe these little sparks we're getting in our static electrical experiments are the same stuff that's up there in a thunderstorm. But what Franklin contributed was he imagined an experiment to test this. And the idea is that a lightning bolt is just a great big spark. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of a profound idea that began to unite the experiments going on in polite little drawing rooms with the whole heavens above us.
So they were trying to prove that lightning was, in fact, electricity, and the electricity they were able to see in the static electricity that they were seeing was on these globes that you rub your hand over, and it
did. Right. It was the social rage. Okay. Everyone was doing it, including sharp, insightful thinkers like Franklin.
So because the Frenchman tried to duplicate this experiment and died as a result of it, are we to assume that Franklin was not really successful at it because he lived to tell the tale, so to speak?
For many other reasons, and that'd take too long to go into, but really the only comment he wrote about it during his lifetime, it doesn't say, if you read it carefully, that he did it. He said it had been performed in Philadelphia. You might do this, you might do that. Anyone could do this. It's a blow-off to do it easily. And as I found with various experiments I did with how you'd have to set the thing up, it was not so easy. Maybe perhaps not impossible, but really a bit tricky.
Was the idea for the lightning to strike the kite and have the current run down the string to the key, was that what he was trying to do?
Well, I'm not sure if he was clear about that. If lightning had struck the kite, the twine that descended below would have vaporized. So obviously lightning didn't strike his kite. But during a thunderstorm, there's increased static electrical energy in the air. And so you should be able to get electricity traveling down your twine to below where you can make experiments with it, just as you might deal with a spark in your own drawing room.
And we all know, Brad, that the only people who are allowed outside in bad weather are weathermen on television saying, please don't come out, the weather's bad. So what's your take on this? Do you think Franklin was able to do this, or would he have died does a kite in a thunderstorm, is the kite more likely to be struck, or are you?
Oh, the kite would be struck, but because the kite was probably constructed of materials that really weren't, you know, conducive for conducting electricity, he's right. It would have probably vaporized most of the kite. I wonder if his experiment was more about just static electricity. Maybe he was trying to induce a charge, because if you had a kite with, especially with silk, which if you have silk clothing on, you know how you can rub it together and get a nice static charge going. Maybe he was trying to induce a charge between the end of the kite and down to the key.
And if he had been successful at doing that, what would have happened? Would the key have gone to ground? Would there have been a bolt of lightning to the ground?
He probably could have created a small-scale static charge from the key down to his hand or to the ground. Probably not enough to kill him, but enough that it would have proved to him that lightning was, in fact, static electricity on a mega scale.
So he did not need lightning for his experiment, and that means, Tom, that you're doing the experiment not in a lightning storm was valid.
Sure, and about 2 or 3 years later in France, some people set up and tried to do these experiments, and they found on a clear day, blue sky overhead, you could send your kite up, and sometimes there would be static electrical energies up there that would travel down your twine.
So, Laura, you mentioned Tom Tucker in your book. Where do you come down on this? Did Franklin conduct this experiment? And if not, did it become part of the lore that sealed his popularity in our minds?
I think it's sort of along the lines of George Washington and the cherry tree. You know, the people who argued for he must have actually done this had to come up with reasons why he didn't spell out where it was done, you know, what the conditions were and how it all happened. And some of the people have argued things like, well, he was embarrassed to be playing with a children's toy or something like that. So I think that anyone who was conducting a scientific experiment and wanted to, you know, show the results to the world would record all of that. So, yeah, I would put it in the myth category.
And Tom Tucker, you call your book Benjamin Franklin and His Electric Kite Hoax. So you're saying it was a hoax. It didn't happen.
Well, that kind of bothers me a little about my title in retrospect. I mean, he's a gentleman who throughout his life played perhaps more hoaxes than people realized till long after he was dead. But what he imagined, at least, had immense resonant power, you know, for the age of reason. Here's a natural philosopher out there braving nature at its most deadly in the pursuit of truth. And this identity was important to Franklin later when he represented us at France trying to get money to wage the war of revolution.
Tom Tucker is a retired instructor at Isothermal Community College. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk to us about this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And still with us, Laura Lee, author of Blame It on the Rain, How Weather Has Changed the Course of History. Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist with WCNC-TV, as we talk about the impact of weather on history. The first big impact that you write about, that you mentioned, Laura, in your book, wasn't even human history, in a sense. It was the history of the dinosaurs. And that, of course, is the meteor strike that many scientists believe resulted in the demise of the dinosaurs, which made way for mammals and therefore human beings. It wasn't the strike, though, that did them in. It was the weather created by the strike. How many other natural non-man-made events have resulted in changes in weather that changed history?
Non-natural man-made events? Well, I'm thinking of, if I'm understanding the question right, I'm thinking of the volcano of Krakatoa.
Okay.
I didn't write about volcanoes because they're not weather phenomenon, except in terms of how they impacted the weather. And that volcano was so dramatic that it spewed so much ash and soot into the atmosphere that it created these vivid sunsets and these displays all the way to Europe. People reported them in North America, seeing these, you know, bright, vivid skies. And one of the interesting things for me in the book, because there's a lot about battles and that sort of thing, I was always looking for something that was a little bit different, mm-hmm. is that the painting, The Scream, that dramatic, that frightening sky in that painting, may have been a sunset that was created by this Krakatoa volcano that the artist actually witnessed and that had an impact on him and inspired him. And a lot of paintings and artists were inspired by those skies that were created by that event. Hmm.
Of course, in modern times, we've heard talk, Brad, of nuclear winter, which might occur after a nuclear holocaust or the global warming or climate change that we appear to be going through, possibly being the result of altering our atmosphere. Would these events be similar to what happened when a meteor took out the dinosaurs and changed the weather?
Obviously, that was on a huge scale because it blocked out the sun for not months, for years and years and years. Just the impact itself probably devastated most of the northern hemisphere if it hit, you know, around the Yucatan Peninsula where we think it hit. But if you put so much particulate matter, basically the earth, parts of the earth were transported into the sky and were suspended in the air for years. You had no sunlight, so that meant you had no plant life, which basically slowly killed all the the omnivores and the herbivore dinosaurs, and then the carnivore dinosaurs had nothing to eat when they all died, and so they killed off all the dinosaurs. Nowadays, it would take a massive high-latitude volcano to replicate something like that. And I say high latitude because volcanic eruptions near the equator, the particles don't get suspended in the air or get transported to higher latitudes because there's just the jet streams aren't as strong near the equator as they are higher north. A good example, if you want, in modern time that's not on that scale would be Mount Pinatubo in 1991 in the Philippines. The year that that volcano erupted, we actually had 1 year of about a degree and a half cooling worldwide just because of the amount of blockage of sun because of the particulate matter that was suspended in the atmosphere for about 12 to 18 months. So just a volcano like Pinatubo, if that were to erupt, and as a scientist, you look at climate change, things that could reverse it would be a massive volcanic eruption at high latitude. It may actually offset some of the warming that is occurring currently.
Your book is called Blame It on the Rain, so let's talk about the rain. Weather played a role in foiling the Roman invasion of Germany in 7 BC. The mighty Roman legions were done in by rain. How so? Laura?
Well, they were done in by rain and also by slaves. Usually, a combination of weather and hubris tends to do them in. I wrote this some time ago, and I don't remember the details. And
let me help you out here, because I do know
informed
the
about it.
Let me help you out. Evidently, it rained so hard that the Roman soldiers became bogged down, literally knee deep in mud, and couldn't move. And I find that amazing that it can rain that hard that quickly. I can understand how vehicles that weigh several thousand pounds get bogged down. How do men get bogged down in the mud up to their knees, and how unusual would that be? How much would it have had to have rained, Brad, for that to happen?
It would have had to rain for days on end, and depending on the soil type, that would have been, you know, where their field of battle was would have played a huge role as well in, you know, how the rain turned the soil basically into quicksand.
But essentially, Laura, you say that this event really changed the course of history because it was such a terrible experience, a tragic and disastrous experience for the Roman legionnaires, that they never invaded the Germanic tribes again, and the Germanic tribes were then given free rein to spread out over Europe.
That's right. And I think another aspect about why they sunk, besides the wet ground, is they were wearing armor and things like that, so they were heavier than a soldier today would be, so that helped them to kind of sink into that ground. It's not as easy to move around in that armor as
of course, but unlike the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz, they didn't rust solid.
They did not. They just sank.
Another weather event that ended Edward III of England's constant invasions of France was a thunderstorm in 1360, in which lightning was said to have struck and killed his armor-wearing knights. I guess their metal was attracting the lightning, along with hailstones the size of pigeon eggs. I don't know how big a pigeon egg is, but how big do hailstones get? Baseball size, I know, right?
Yeah, baseball to softball size. Some of the biggest hailstones recorded in the world have been in South Dakota, believe it or not, and those were basically the size of about 7.5 inches in diameter.
Lord.
So they get large, and usually when they get that large, it's several hailstones together, but typically baseball to softball size is the peak of the hail around the United States.
And since they can put dents in cars, they can certainly put dents in armor and people. We have to stop. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting author David Sedaris for One Night Only, April 22nd in Belk Theater, reading new unpublished stories and hosting a book signing. Tickets now available at 704-372-1000. Germs that are growing more drug-resistant are on the rise in U.S. hospitals. Diane Rehm and her guest will talk about how public health officials are fighting the spread of a group of especially deadly superbugs. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about weather and how it impacts historical events in our daily lives, here today, tomorrow, and going forward, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
In China, pirated Western TV shows are providing fodder for English students looking to hone translation skills.
In my group, there are probably 6 or 7 people doing the same episode, so it's go pretty fast.
Some students say they're learning about democracy along the way. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Laura Lee's book is called Blame It on the Rain, How Weather Has Changed the Course of History. She joins us by phone. Brad Penovich, chief meteorologist from WCNC-TV, the NBC station here in town, is with us in our Spirit Square studio. I want to go back to Edward III, which you mentioned a little while ago, Laura, and which I just mentioned about the battle in 1360, which saw hailstones the size of pigeon eggs and had knights in armor dying because of they were being struck by lightning. You say that Edward, King Edward, saw this as a sign from God, and as a result, took some fairly drastic action after this battle. You don't remember this, do you?
I'm sorry. I don't.
Well, I'll tell you, because I've read the book. You wrote the book how long ago?
I wrote the book 7 years ago.
There you go. Years. You can't remember everything. But since I just skimmed it, he gave up and he signed a treaty ceding everything he had won in that battle to the French. So that another example of how weather can get in the way and alter the course of history. As we went through the book, though, we noticed that there are a lot of events that were history-altering that involved rain and lightning and cold and snow and something we're going to talk about in a second or two, fog. Are there any instances of world events or human events being altered by sun or sun and heat or sun and heat and drought?
Well, the one that I have in the book, and I did mention it earlier, is the Detroit riots, which heat played a very large part in that. In that, it was a very when the riots broke out, it was a very hot day, and people were uncomfortable. There wasn't they didn't have a lot of air conditioning that time in this place, and so. Tempers were high and people were out in the streets, and it just was this powder keg and a spark. So heat does cause those types of things. And I don't know, the thing is that it was very hard to find instances of negatives besides, things that were caused by it being a clear sunny day, because that's not something that people tend to comment on too much. I tried to find things that didn't happen that could have happened because of what happened in the weather. And that's a challenge, too.
Of course, the dust bowls of the 1930s out in the Midwest, which we've seen a kind of repetition of a summer or two ago in Phoenix with the incredible dust storms that came across. And you know, as a meteorologist, that the world appears to be getting drier, and we're talking about the water shortages in the future being what people go to war over, yeah. And that would be a human event or human history being altered by the weather.
Yeah, water resources, just like over the history of mankind, most battles are fought over what religion and land, and most of the land is because of resources. We often think of resources, food, and nowadays fossil fuels, but water is always the number one resource that anybody is looking for. And as water becomes harder and harder to find, especially in inland areas, in mid-continental areas, you will see more, I think, conflict among people for water.
I mean, we hear a lot about water being shorted. There are water shortages in Africa, and but we also hear about them in California, that they've diverted the Colorado River and moved a lot of that water to Los Angeles, and that's causing problems because the population doesn't seem to be getting any smaller out there. It keeps getting larger, and now we have some water issues right here.
Yeah, absolutely. In the Carolinas, this is a drought-prone area. The history of the Carolinas, before man was even here, there were these mega droughts that happen every 6, 7, 8 years, which is pretty typical. Now, luckily for us, we have hydrological waterways like the Catawba River, which has been dammed up by Duke Power. They've done it for hydroelectric production, but the beauty of it is it's also saved us some water mm-hmm. for usage. Because if you think about this area, if there wasn't any people here, it probably would survive a drought a lot better. But because we're demanding so much water, we're actually taking water out of the system quicker than Mother Nature can replenish it.
You know, there was a sinkhole that killed a man in his bed, in his bedroom, in just on the outskirts of Tampa. I think it was last week.
Yep.
Sinkholes in Florida, are they being caused by the draining of the aquifer, which is being drained because of overpopulation of a state that can't support the people that are there?
Probably likely. The thing about Florida, they have a unique type of geography. It's called karst topography. They have a lot of limestone aquifers under Florida. And when you drain that water out, the limestone dissolves very easily. So it creates these gigantic voids mm-hmm. underground. It's like a mine shaft, basically, that was made by nature. And when you remove the water sometimes is the only thing holding the ground up. So you see these massive sinkholes all the time in Florida. And a lot of that likely is due to the amount of water being drawn out of the aquifer by the population. And you talk about, you know, climate change. One of the biggest impacts that man has on our climate is land use change, the way we use the land. And one way we've changed the land, even in Charlotte, is we've paved over so much of Mecklenburg County, for instance, and water that used to sit on the soil and be able to get back into the groundwater now runs off in literally minutes on a parking lot, and it gets into the Sugar Creek Greenway and is downstream in a couple hours. You know, before Charlotte was here, that water would have slowly trickled over the land, would have saturated into the ground. So just the change of land in our area especially has a huge impact on how water is retained in our system.
Let's take a couple phone calls here. Let's go to Statesville. Dennis, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
I got to bring up, this is historical for me. I lived here in North Carolina in 1960 and was in elementary school. And since this is the 43rd anniversary of the three Wednesday snowstorms, I had four-day weekends 3 weeks in a row.
You know, my friend Henry Bogan used to talk about this on his program all the time in the wintertime. This is a legendary thing, and it actually did happen, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. March 1960, not only did it snow every Wednesday for four Wednesdays straight, that is the snowiest month in Charlotte history. Of all winters, this is the snowiest of all time. It beats any December, any January, and any February in Charlotte's history. 19.6 inches of snow fell in March 1960.
And I guess that was a human-altering event because it canceled school 3 weeks in a row on a Friday.
The odd thing is like you hear these stories, because oftentimes I hear these stories and you think, well, they're exaggerating. But no, it did. It snowed every Wednesday for 4 weeks straight.
Oh. All right, I loved it. It was a four-day weekend. For three, can say one of them didn't cancel the whole thing, but then I had 4 day weekends because school was down Thursday. There was enough snow left around on Friday that they shut her down. You know,
and that was
that's historical when you're in elementary school.
Absolutely, Dennis. Thank you for your call. I appreciate
it.
Man. It brings up nice memories for me personally.
Talk
to me about that, because my memory of that, I was not here in 1960. Yeah. I was in the D.C. area, but I remember as a kid growing up. Snows in the wintertime being deep up to my waist. Now, of course, I was shorter, but I do remember that, and I remember frequent big snowstorms. Yeah. Is that my memory playing tricks on me, or are we simply not having those events? Was the 1960 event here so remarkably unusual that it was just a blip on the radar?
I think a little bit of both, because this actually hits to my heart as well, because a snowstorm was actually my inspiration to be a meteorologist. When I was a little kid growing up in Northeast Ohio, in 1978, we had a huge blizzard. And anyone that lived in the Midwest or even the Northeast knows about the late 70s. There were blizzard after blizzard. I remember my dad having to dig out the front door. We couldn't even open the front door. The snow was so deep. And those were my inspirations as a young kid, 6 years old, looking at the snow, wanting to know why, how, what happened. I was just fascinated with bad weather. But when you look back in the late 70s and early 80s, the United States had some of the harshest winters in the late 70s and 80s, and we just have not had that type of pattern since then. Now, some of it may be climate change. Some of it may be other patterns in the atmosphere. We have big oscillations in the Pacific Ocean. One of the things that we sometimes in the world, we think about, you know, what's our localized area doing, but what's going on in the oceans around the world? Sometimes,
just the El Nino and La Nina?
Not even that. We're talking about big Pacific oscillations in the North Atlantic and the North Pacific.
Okay.
These will have huge impacts. And when you get these all lined up, for a several-year period, you can get these big snowstorms. So we just haven't seen that type of pattern set up. There were a couple years ago, two winters ago, we thought we were maybe getting back to that. And then last winter, we had the mildest winter on record for most of the United States. And this year has been a little bit better, but it's still going to end up being a milder winter than we saw in the late 70s and 80s. So I think some of it is our recollection of it, but also the time that a lot of us were growing up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that was just a very, very cold and snowy period in the United States.
It isn't just violent weather or blinding snowstorms or freezing cold that have caused problems for human endeavors down through history. Something as seemingly benign as fog has also been a problem. You're right, Laura. George Washington was able to successfully elude the Redcoats after the Battle of Long Island after a thick fog set in, covering his army's escape. And you write about how the course of Native American history on this continent could have been altered by a fog that enveloped Tecumseh in the War of 1812. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Tecumseh, I mean, he was a rallying point. He was a hero for the Native American tribes, and it was amazing to people that he was taken down in a battle, that basically the fog allowed for him to be taken down, and so it was a great blow to them, and it was one of those things that they couldn't believe could happen.
They the Native Americans, or they the people they were fighting about, didn't believe it could happen.
Well, I think both, but especially for the Native Americans, a blow.
Well, let's talk about that. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, because he was such a rallying figure and such a hope for them that it was a battle that he should not have lost.
Well, let's talk about fog for a second, Bray. I think we all know what fog is. It's a low-hanging cloud. But why does it form, and why wouldn't Native Americans, who were pretty darned in tune with nature at the time, not know that this fog was going to roll in, or that it would develop, or that it would impede their ability to be successful in a battle?
Well, fog is one of those things that it's pretty easy to forecast nowadays, but I would imagine back when the Native Americans were trying to figure out if it was going to form or not form, they probably had a general idea, but knowing when it was going to break up was probably extremely difficult. Most of early weather history and forecasting was based on pure observation. You would find even the ancient Greeks and Native Americans, they learned about weather patterns based on just experience. They would observe certain things in nature and know within 12 or 24 hours it was going to snow, or it was going to get foggy, or it was going to get stormy. So a lot of times their experiences would lead to helping them figure out what was going to happen, but they didn't know how long it was going to last.
Yeah.
So fog, you know, basically you just have the air temperature and dew point, something we talk about a lot on TV. When those are equal, you have 100% humidity, you have a fog. It's pretty easy to forecast. Sometimes the difficulty we have is how long does it take to break up? If it's a certain time of year, the sun angle isn't high enough, you don't have wind, you can't break it up quick enough.
The U.S. military was involved in trying to drop salt into fog during a battle in Vietnam without much success. Would the salt be to dissipate the fog or to encourage?
It would basically be to dissipate the fog, and I would think that would be really hard to do.
Why would salt work?
How
would you disperse it?
What you're trying to do in fog, and most fog dispersion is done either two ways. You try to warm up the air, or you try to mix up the air. In the salt case, what you're trying to do is salt is going to absorb. It's going to attract water. So what you're trying to do is drop salt into the fog layer. It absorbs some of the moisture, and the moisture precipitates out or drops to the ground.
And in Vietnam, we also tried to seed the clouds so that the Ho Chi Minh Trail would stay wet all the time for the North Vietnamese soldiers to make it difficult for them. If seeding the clouds worked in that case, why haven't we seeded the clouds over Texas?
Well, the problem is sometimes you need clouds first to seed. And that's the thing about weather modification, seeding clouds. Even though it can be done to some small degree, you still need a little help from Mother Nature. To seed a cloud, you have to have Mother Nature kind of create the clouds to begin with. The one thing we haven't figured out is we can't make clouds out of nothing. You still need moisture in the atmosphere. And the atmosphere still, even though as powerful as man is still a very large, multifaceted thing that we cannot get our hands around.
Which leads me to this, because I know that looking to the future, the Air Force has been considering for several years how to alter the weather. They did us a research paper called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. They wrote this in the 90s, in which they hope to gain the ability to shape weather patterns. That would necessitate a much more thorough understanding of variables that make up the weather. Is that something that you think we'll have a handle on in the next 15 to 30 years, really, to be able to do this? Because they have all kinds of plans for doing this.
I honestly don't, because I've seen this before, this paper, and I've also seen some researchers in Florida who wanted to create what's something we call Dynagel. It was a product they wanted to dump in thunderstorms to help deter or stir away hurricanes from Florida. The problem was they needed massive amounts of aircraft and a massive amount of this
stuff
and they only were able to impact one little thunderstorm.
Yeah.
And a hurricane is made up of literally hundreds of thousands of thunderstorms.
If we were able to do this, as they hope to be able to do this in the next 15 to 30 years, is this kind of like altering the crops? Could this be potentially dangerous, unintended consequences of altering weather patterns?
It absolutely is. In the case I just referred to, it may seem like a very plausible thing to deter hurricanes. But here's the thing, Mike. Hurricanes are a necessity in nature. They actually serve a purpose. They help distribute heat from the equator to the poles and counterbalance that. If we don't have it, then there's another big storm that's going to form somewhere else.
There's a reason for everything in the ecosystem, and we shouldn't screw with it. Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV here locally. Laura Lee, author of Blame It on the Rain, How Weather Has Changed the Course of History. Thank you for the hour.